Welcome to the Atom Ventures podcast. My name is Bhairav Patel. I'm the managing director of Atom Ventures and Atom CTO. And today I'm here with Dr. Ian Philp from Aged Care Technologies. Say hello, Ian.
Hello, Bhairav. Nice to see you.
So today we're going to be talking about age tech, elderly care. This is a topic that's obviously important to me because not only am I aging, but I have aging parents. But I think this is something that's it's touching everyone right now, especially during the pandemic. And so what I'd like to touch on is your experience, obviously your vast experience in this field, but also what you're doing with aged care technology. So let's start off and tell a bit about your background. So let people know who you are and what you've been doing.
Yeah, well, I trained originally as a doctor. And when I was a medical student, I discovered geriatrics, which became my inspiration to work with older people. Throughout my career, I've spent time as a doctor, as a researcher and educator. I've done policy work nationally and internationally. I've been in service management, leading and managing work in the National Health Service in the UK. And I've done some media work to promote ideas about aging in older people. And now, age 62, I'm a founder of a small startup using a business model to try to improve the lives of older people.
Yes, I did see your media video online, so we'll get to that a little bit later on. Before we get on to the next set of questions, when I was doing my research, I heard that there's a story about an elderly man's prolapse that is what got you into working in geriatrics. Is that true?
Well, it is true. While I was attached as a medical student to an elderly care specialty unit that was really terrific, place which was both humane and practical and dynamic and made a difference. One of the things we had to do as medical students was to do a night shift as a nurse care assistant. And there was an older man, an elderly man on the ward who's in his 80s. He had a rectal prolapse, which literally his bottom had fallen out of his bottom. Sorry to be so graphic. And the nurse in the ward gave me a pair of gloves and said, your job is to squeeze back the prolapse so it goes back into his bottom, which I wasn't very skilled at doing. And it took quite a time, over an hour, I think, during the middle of the night. And the man told me stuff that he needed to get off his chest about his experiences in the First World War, which he hadn't said he hadn't been able to tell anyone. But he needed to do this before he died. And I realized what an extraordinary privilege it was to work with older people. I think you live life forwards, but you understand life looking backwards. And old people approaching their end of their lives have so much wisdom based on life experience and such a great need, if you like, to believe that their life made sense and they'd made a contribution and therefore they're able to accept death, which most older people are, that I just thought this is... it's just so wonderful working with old people and to have the privilege of being able to do things that will help them in very obvious and practical ways, like just helping get a rectal prolapse sorted. But and in so doing, just learn a bit more about what it is to be a human being from the perspective of old age. So there was so much in that that I didn't expect to be the source of my inspiration for my career, but it was.
What do you see the challenges that older people are facing at the moment? And has that changed so much over the years, or are they the same?
They're very similar over the last 40 years. The biggest thing is that there's a large amount of unmet need and unmet suffering in old age, which is not addressed because there's a belief that certain things old people live with, they have to live with them, it's just aging. There's nothing that could be done, and I don't want to bother the doctor. So unnecessary suffering due to loneliness, pain, needing help with activities of daily living, being a burden on your family, things which some old people regard as worse than death, actually, are things that can be sorted with a little bit of help. And that was true when I started my career 40 years ago, and it's true today, and it's true around the world. And I believe it's due to sort of just very uninformed assumptions that we have about what old age is like. And we don't know what it's like till we experience it. We don't know fully what it's like till we experience it. And as we experience it, many old people get disempowered. And yet, the irony, Bhairav, is that we spend vast amounts of money caring for the aging population, both in hospitals and in long-term care institutions. And yet we don't always meet the needs that older people have, and we don't do the things that really would improve quality of life in old age. And that challenge remains. And aged care technologies, I set it up because I think we have proven solutions to reducing suffering and improving quality of life in old age, and actually creating systems that are sustainable financially with the aging of populations. And what has changed is that there are more older people in the world, especially people aged 80 and above. But actually, this shift in the UK to an aging society started transitioning rapidly in the 1950s and 60s. So it's not new to talk about the aging of the population. In other parts of the world, particularly in East and Southeast Asia, there's a really rapid aging of populations. In 10, 15 years, a total transformation of these societies towards an old age population. And then in poor countries around the world, the problem is that poor countries are also aging. And the thing is, the rich world got rich before it got old, but in poor countries, are getting old while they're still poor. And that makes it even more challenging to respond to the changing demographic.
So there's obviously a lot in there to discuss. And before we get into how ACT, aged care technologies, is helping solve some of these problems, can I ask, why have we let it come to where it is? Because it's not like it's a surprise that we age. And as you say, so much money is put in. Is it the fact that we're not measuring the effects of the money that's being put in, or why is it?
I think it's because decision makers, the most powerful people in our society, not through any bad intent, but see the world through their own eyes. And because decision makers tend not to be old people with the understanding of what aging is as an old person, we tend to develop policies and practices that are an extension of our own beliefs. And also, I think the other thing is, on the other hand, we know older people, but we think because we can relate to the experience of one, the three or four older people, our grandparents, whatever, in our families have gone through, and what we've gone through perhaps as caregivers, we think that's the story. And people think they're experts on aging because they know one or two older people. But I know, and there's a lot of educational research about this, that there's two thresholds that you have to pass before you really can understand how to care for older people as a practitioner, or indeed as a provider, or as a policymaker, or as a developer of products and services to meet the needs of older people. And one threshold is to understand complexity that comes with aging. Aging doesn't reduce us to a more simple understanding. It actually, you differentiate more as you get older, and every older person is unique. When you've met one older person, you've met one older person. So understanding the complexity that goes to make up an older person is really fundamentally important, and it can be quite scary. Not, you don't have the knowledge to understand that. And so prejudice comes in at that point. And the other threshold, which I think is easier to relate to actually, is understanding compassion. And to approach every older person through the lens of compassion, about trying to see the world from their point of view, and not to impose our view of the world upon an older person. So people that are expert in the care of older people take a compassionate view that looks at the world from the older person's point of view. And they also have a good knowledge and grasp of the complexity of conditions, underlying medical problems, the circumstances affecting the older person, the psychological processes that they're going through as well. It is complex. You need to understand the biological, the social, the psychological, the environmental, financial construct, and the cohort through which an older person has lived. So if you go back to the old man with the rectal prolapse, I was fortunate just to catch the end of the generation that had experienced the First World War firsthand when I started my career. And their experience of aging is different, whether they fought in the war or they were the women who were left behind, many of whom never remarried. Their lives were shaped by the legacy of that experience. More recently, we've had the veterans of the Second World War, Captain Tom, who are now dying out, and they carry with them a set of attitudes and behaviours that were unique to their generation. We now have the generation of people that grew up in the boomer period with very high expectations that will be more demanding. To understand older people, you need to look at it from so many different lenses that it's difficult to do it properly. And it's easier to revert to some stereotypes that allow for simple systems, medical processes, and policies to evolve that are not attuned as they should be to the needs of older people.
I think when you talk about stereotypes, essentially what we're doing is just lumping the older generation is with one in one group, right? And as you say, not really looking at the complexities of each of their stories. I think from a technology point of view, what I see is that the older generations are often seen as an afterthought. So when you look at we talk about the youth of today, right? All the focus is on the youth of the next generation and what they're going to bring and how they'll bring social impact and change. And so even in technology, people are developing for the youngsters and they're not really considering that there's still a very large aging population that can't adopt technology as quickly or can't adapt to change as quickly, and then they're being ignored and then being told, oh, well, you can't adapt, so therefore we ignore you. And I get that sense from what you're talking about, that is over time where it's more of an afterthought dealing with the elderly rather than a forethought. Would that be right?
Which is a fundamental business mistake, because the silver economy is the big economy. 80% of assets and 80% of disposable income is now in the hands of old people around the world. Now, old people might be reluctant to spend it in certain generations of older people, certain classes of older people, but we're seeing an increasing financial power that older people have. And in fact, it creates intergenerational inequalities that badly affect younger people who live in a much less financially secure world than their parents or grandparents may have lived in. And this is a bit of the irony about it, that in fact, we've neglected older people a lot. But the people that neglected older people, I would say, is the baby boomer generation that had it all. And now they're getting old. And I think they're going to claim it all next. And for the tech community, you know, get it. Let's start designing for this older generation of high spending, wealthy, asset rich, expectation high generation of old people. But as we do that, the other side of my feeling about it is that that's not all old people. There are many old people that are still going to be living in poverty or experiencing huge amounts of distress and so on. And we need an offer for these groups as well.
No, I think there's been a theme over the last few podcasts where boomers do kind of, there's a lot of blame aimed at the doorsteps of the boomers. But let's talk about something more positive, aged care technologies. So what is the mission for aged care technologies?
Well, it's simply to improve significantly the lives of 100 million older people around the world by 2030. We believe we've got the tools and we've got the routes to market and partnerships that could do that. How would we do that? The assessment tool, which is the core of our business, is the unique tool that now we can deliver it online, put it into the hands of anybody who is working with old people, that it will allow the person who's working with the old person to help understand what the particular concerns and priorities are of the older person and connect them to resources to meet their needs. And this is for old people who are living at home, who are experiencing some threats to their health, independence, or well-being. And we know that that tool, on average, adds one extra year of quality of life per older person assessed, an extra 1 year of quality life. and reduces the time that they're likely to spend in hospital or needing long-term support, and will reduce the burden on their family members as well. It's building their resilience. So that's one thing. And associated with it, we have our training, ACT training, which is the tool developed to train people in contact with old people how to assess and mobilize resources to meet older people's needs. We've realized there's a gap in education, and we've created a suite of training programs also available online, easy to access, easy to use, easy to scale, and also easy to accredit and get recognition for the training, that fills out the knowledge gap, you know, that I was talking about earlier. You know, we need to understand complexity, and we need to understand how to care with compassion. And this is what our training provides. And then we've got data, and the data we get automatically off the back of the assessment and the training. And these data provide us with substantiated information about what really matters to older people and where the gaps are, that can help policymakers and help businesses develop the products and services that will address the things which really matter to older people. So we see these tools of the ACT assessment, ACT training, ACT analytics as being catalysts that help drive whole systems, ecosystems of care for older people around the things which matter most to older people, and allow care to be delivered that's appropriate to meet their needs.
Just the statistic of a year improvement in life is amazing. Do you have any kind of stories that you can talk about where the assessment has really shown? Have you got any feedback from people that have taken the assessment and how their lives have improved?
Thank you. Well, we've done validation work, BIRAV, in 50 countries, every WHO region of the world. And some of them are quite small studies, but they give us very powerful stories. And we have a YouTube video of this, Health Nest Uganda, Easy Care it's called, where we developed our training and we developed the assessment tool and put it into the hands of community volunteers who go out to the rural villages in Uganda, train the community, and then start to address the needs of the older person. And there's a lovely picture in this YouTube video of this very, very old person coming out of a hut. You can't tell if it's man or woman, sort of on a stake, being assisted to sit down, getting their nails done, their feet washed. Other things, there's working with them, a sort of very compassionate, gentle, community oriented rehabilitation program, if you like. And then it's a she, actually, and she gets up and she walks proudly back to her hut. And then the screenshot comes down and says, this 104-year-old woman was assessed as having the following 8 needs using the ACT approach, and which we called Easy Care in these days. And that, you know, built up her strength. Then we've got, you know, that's Uganda. That's perhaps the most challenging place. If anyone says, well, what's the point in finding out what's the problem if you can't do anything about it? Well, that's the evidence you can. Back in the UK, we did a project in the town of Bridlington where 1,500 older people were offered the assessment. And wonderful stories of people haven't asked me before about these things. I didn't know that you could get help for this and that. My life is transformed. You know, 140 people were poor older people were informed that they could get advice about their finances, and that released £500,000 worth of unclaimed benefits. £500,000.
It's huge.
Huge. Old people in richer communities, but were living isolated, alone, you know, in a big drafty house without visits, were deeply lonely and depressed, and said, well, since you put me in contact with this befriending service, life is worth living again. Our mission is 100 million older people, but every one of them has their story, you know? And it's easier, I think, to relate to these individual stories. So, you know, thank you for asking me about that.
So one of the things I'd like to do on this podcast is obviously try and give practical advice. And as people who are listening to this will have elderly parents and most likely will be looking after one or more elderly relatives, what practical advice can you give? Because it seems to me that actually the assessment is a great way of saying, okay, at finding out what the struggles are, what the the kind of issues may be for an elderly person? Is there something that they can take from that and implement it within their own lives?
So family caregiving, as we've said, is the bedrock of care to older people. In isolation, it's a lonely place to be, and many family carers don't know where to go for help and assume that they have to carry the burden on their own. And there are reasons why they shouldn't carry the burden on their own. There are far fewer family members to care for the numbers of older people that are now. We've got this sort of inversion of the family pyramid of usually two grandparents, four children, eight grandchildren. It's more like one grandchild, two parents, four grandparents now. And so the load is greater. And with economic migration, families are not as close as they were in the past. But that doesn't mean that families have stopped caring for older people. There's evidence that, you know, attitudes of love and care and duty and respect for older people remain as constant as they ever were, even in Western societies that are sometimes characterized as being less friendly to older people. But the loving bonds remain there. What I would say is that, I've done research with colleagues across Europe about family caregiving in 11 European countries, contrasting, you know, sort of Mediterranean family-oriented cultures with the Nordic, more independent living countries. But the family bonds remain, and the main part of caring, family caregiving, is experience is positive. The positives usually, nearly always, outweigh the negatives because of the satisfactions people get from caring for a loved elderly parent. But there are negative impacts, and they can be financial, they can be psychological, they can be social, that can create stress and difficulties for family members. And the big message I've got is that you should seek help if there are these, because there are generally, and this UK is actually compares quite well internationally in terms of offering support to caregivers. More should and could be done. So we've actually, through Aged Care Technologies, and built on previous research I did on working with caregivers, to develop a tool for the caregiver that sits alongside the assessment tool for the older person. We call the tool the COPE Index. That came out of Carers of Older People in Europe, where the research was done. And we've shown that asking 15 questions helps determine where you are on the range of positive value, negative impact, and quality of support. And then if you're an outlier, if you've got very low positive value from caregiving, but you're having a high negative impact, you definitely need help, because that's a dangerous situation to be in. If you've got high positive value, you'll cope with high negative impact if you get help and support, and you should ask for it, you know. And then for many of us, you know, the spectrum between being a caregiver and just being a family member means that we wouldn't recognize ourselves as caregivers. We just do it because that's, you know, what you do. But the value of the COPE Index is it identifies, Bhairav, this sort of a small minority of people that are at high risk, and the slightly larger numbers that are not at high risk, but nevertheless need help and support to make their life easier as a caregiver and to improve the quality of life of the older person they care for.
Are there any kind of indicators that you could mention now? I mean, we don't want to diagnose anybody or kind of give advice without understanding some of the situation, but are there any tendencies or things that traits that people might recognize in themselves and that they should then go and seek help for?
Yeah, I think it relates to largely the behavior and impact of the older person on them and whether they perceive that to be a problem. Now, the biggest stressors are behavioral disturbance. So, you know, typically in the context of a demented older relative who might not understand the situation, might hit out, be verbally or physically aggressive. That's often a cause of major stress. Sleep disturbance is another one. Fecal incontinence, you know, lack of control of your bowels, is a major stressor. And then there's the impact that happens because of the time taken up with caregiving, out of your normal life, or the burden that you feel because you're worried about the older person in your family. And that there's something I call the distant relative syndrome, which is that it's actually often more stressful worrying about an older relative who doesn't live near you. And you're just worried, what's going to happen? Because I'm not there, and it's tied up with feelings of duty and guilt. I mean, if you're living distantly and you're worried about your older relative, that can be quite stressful as well. Now, I think any of these triggers justify going to speak to somebody about it. You can start with your friends, if you like, and talk it through and in the family and try and share out the load a bit. But you could also go to and see your GP to say you're worried about this, and the GP may be able to give you some help.
Very interesting. So I guess someone listening to this might start thinking, well, getting old isn't very fun. But you're not really saying that. What you're saying is that there is help out there as you age in order to improve your life. So I guess if we're looking at some of the younger audience now who may be thinking, well, you know, how does this really relate to me? Is there anything that you would say to them, not only about them handling with, you know, dealing with elderly relatives, but about themselves and their own aging process?
Yeah, well, the first thing I'd say is that the life satisfaction surveys suggest that we're at peak unhappiness between the age of 40 and 50.
Wow.
And we improve life satisfaction at least up to the age of 70 or 80, generally. So, you know, if you think life is bad now, it's going to get worse. Well, it might be true in the former, but on the latter, there's some grounds for optimism. Now, what can you do then, as a younger person to have the best aging that you can have? And, while I was doing research for some of these television programs I've done on how to live longer and themes like that, there are eight things. There are eight things you should pay attention to. I'll try and remember them. I've not written them down, but let's go through them if we've got time.
Yeah, go for it.
So number one, don't get isolated socially. Having social connection is the best predictor of healthy aging. And that can be large and superficial connections, or it can be small and deep and meaningful connections according to your personality, what works for you. Social connection, number one. Number two is physical activity. And I'm afraid I'm not following my own advice in lockdown. I sort of lost my routine of going to the gym and going out. But, you know, so I'm getting unhealthier. Many of us might have found that. But really, you should try and build as much normal physical activity into your life. It's why people in, for example, men in Sardinia have the longest life expectancy of men in the world. They live on mountains and they're shepherds. And it's just normal to be hiking up and down a slope, which is good for your cardiovascular system. So physical activity is number two. Clean air is number three. There's strong evidence now that the air that we breathe is killing us, and it causes dementia and strokes and heart attacks and chest problems. So if you can find, and this is terrible for people that you know live in polluted cities and can't get away from it, try if you can to at least give your lungs a breather when you have a chance to get away, or ideally live in an area which has clean air. That's number three. And, you know, don't leave your car idling at the side of the road, because you're poisoning other people. We'll become more and more aware of this one. Number four, mental activity. And it's about trying out new ways to challenge your brain. And that helps with what we call cognitive aging. It's how you age mentally. Number five is about stress and sleep. And some people get into mindfulness and things like this, but ways in which you can get away from the stresses of daily life. And the best test is whether you sleep well or not. It's actually not great advice sometimes to give for people that are not sleeping well, because one of the things that you don't sleep well about is worrying about not sleeping well. But It's a good measure of that. And it's one way where alcohol is quite bad for aging, because alcohol, one of the detrimental effects is that it interferes with sleep patterns. You might get, you know, feel very tired and fall asleep, but you will have broken, fragmented and unhelpful sleep is a great restorer. And there are techniques, and I've not got time to go into it now, but there are techniques around sleep hygiene that people can, you know, look at. But that was five, I think. Number six is diet. And diet is, it's not just what you eat, it's how you eat. So people live a long time in places like Southwest France, where the diet is pretty poor, but the way they eat is through family gathering and eating slowly and sharing. And, you know, and so it's the benefits of the sort of socialization of eating with a rich, varied diet. Although we do tend to see longevity societies, which are more plant-based, more fish-based, but actually are more just, you know, we see natural local ingredients that we take advantage of in our cooking. Number seven is physical appearance and self-esteem, that, you know, feeling good about how you look does really affect your aging. And you can get into this vicious cycle of feeling you're not looking as great. And funnily enough, I was surprised by this, is that as you get older into your 60s and 70s, it's men that are more badly affected by poor self-esteem than women are. Maybe because it's an escape from male gaze for women. I've heard some older women talk about the release from having to look good. but for men, it's about looking in the mirror and seeing your grandfather and thinking about the loss of your virility as a man. So, and the one thing that I did following the recent TV program that I had to change in my lifestyle was I started to moisturize, because my wife had been telling me for years to do it and I couldn't be bothered. And then I thought, oh, actually, it makes you look a bit better. It makes you look a bit younger, makes you feel better about yourself. And then wrapped around all of that, Bhairav, is purpose. Finding purpose in life, finding your path, finding meaning in life is what integrates all of it. And it's actually the thing, when you talk to old people prior to their death, the surprising thing is that the old people most are accepting of their death. They don't see it as tragic. They're able to move on in a way that as a younger person, you might be more scared of dying. And the reason that older people give is that they feel that they had a life that had been worth living. That's the reason. Because I feel I had a life that was worth living, that I found a purpose, they're able to say, well, now I'm ready to move on. So that they would be the things. It's not actually a magic bullet. It's a set of eight principles, really, and things that you should try to adjust in your own life to maximize the benefits in these areas.
And everything you've said is very sensible. And actually, it's what most people are echoing out there in the world anyway, right, at the moment. And so, yes, hopefully we're getting, I think the last one with purpose, hopefully we're getting towards that more with, you know, what you see around you with the younger generation talking about social impact and really doing jobs that have meaning rather than necessarily worrying about the money you earn. But that's a whole different podcast, I think. So we are moving towards the end of the podcast. There's a whole bunch of things I wanted to ask you, but we were not got time to. So there's only two really other things I want to ask you about. First one is starting a business. You know, as you said, you know, 62 years old, you started a business fairly late. And you came from academia. How was that?
Pulls apart. Starting a business, I at first I felt completely fish out of water. But I did a course for a small business leader at Aston Business School. It really helped me understand what I was good at and what I needed help with and where what you needed to be a successful small business leader. So I now regard myself as that primarily. And it's very liberating, and it's very demanding. And in a day, you go through all the emotions, and you have good bits and you have bad bits, and you develop resilience. But my grandfather was an entrepreneur and small businessman, and I now look to him as my role model. He was driving around Kirkcaldy selling carpets at the age of 80 with his secretary in his Rover car with him. And he was the first man to have a colour TV in Kirkcaldy and stuff like that. So you get loads of pluses and you get loads of challenges, and life is never boring.
So would you recommend it to other people that may be starting post 50 to start a business?
I've been very fortunate in that I was able to take my pension. I had a good health service pension, so it's taken some of the financial pressure off. I think anybody at my age who's materially well off, yeah, start a business. You know, give yourself a reason to have another 30, 40 years of active life if you're fortunate. Follow my 8 principles.
Excellent. All right, so the last question, which is a question I ask everybody. If you could go back in time 20 years and give advice to your younger self, what would that advice be?
I would say, Bhairav, that I was in my 40s and work became so dominant that I didn't spend as much time as I should have done with my family and my friends. And I would say always make time for that. That should come first.
And I sense that you're making up for it now.
As a new grandpa, I'm making up for it, and I'm with the family around. Unfortunately, they're still around.
Excellent. Well, it's been a pleasure speaking to you, Ian.
A pleasure speaking to you. Thank you for letting me go on at some length about my passion.
No, it's great, and it's great to hear, and I think people can take away a lot from this podcast. So thanks for that.
Thanks, Bhairav. All the best.